Hello, everybody. Welcome to episode 85 of the Alexi Sale podcast. Mm-hmm. And fuck me, what a week it's been for us, Talal, here at Alexi Sale House near the roundabout in Uxbridge. My God, que pasa, hombre?
That's right, hombre. You've had quite the week indeed.
But quite the fucking week.
You've become a viral superstar.
Viral TikTok superstar. Have we actually gone viral now?
I could confidently say you're viral. You need to go to your doctor and get checked out. There's something really viral about you.
They'll be developing a vaccine. Yeah.
So to catch our listeners up, and hello to any new listeners who've joined because of our new viral condition. A few weeks back during our live show, you suggested you wanted to do a TikTok dance and then stop dancing and talk about Marxism.
Yeah.
That was kind of the pitch, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And so on a sunny day last week, we went to your back garden.
You actually had to show up. I had a kind of idea, a platonic idea, as it were, of what a TikTok dance was, but then you had to actually show me the reality. Yeah.
We sat in your garden and I showed you some TikTok dances and we sat for about 10 minutes. And at one point I turned to you and I said, it's kind of weird that we're sitting here looking at a bunch of teenage girls dancing, isn't it, Alex? We had to both acknowledge the weirdness of the moment. But then, we figured out a little routine and I just picked the top trending song of the time. Arpater. And got you dancing and talking about
Marxism.
Let me give you a rundown of the stats, Alexi. We did three videos, okay? Part one, part two, part three. All the same song, all the same dance. Different Marx facts. And on TikTok, the first video has now garnered 275,000 views.
Right. Excellent.
I know it's not very, it's a bit gauche to sit and talk about your views, but this is very new for both of us. So we have to analyze this. The second video got 96,900 views.
Right.
So got a bit of a dip there.
Yeah.
And the third video, I posted it and I had a very frustrating day because it kept getting muted and I'd post it again. And it would be muted. And I was like, why aren't the last two muted? Is it something to do with the song copyright? And then it took me fucking a couple of hours to figure out that the video we did as a joke, the last one, you gave the longest explanation of Marx theory.
Right.
And that was kind of a joke that the description was longer than the dance. Yeah.
Yeah.
But because the video was just over a minute long, anything over a minute, your music gets muted on TikTok. So I then had to go in and like re-edit it and it's a bit jumpy. It looks almost fake because you're dancing and then suddenly you're talking and then suddenly you're dancing again. So that one on TikTok has only got 2,300 views.
Right.
Embarrassing.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm not done yet. We are definitely viral and I'll tell you why. But some of the comments on TikTok have made me weep with joy. They're like, where were you when I was doing my mocks? Why can't my sociology teacher incorporate dance into this? Some of them like, I'm a professor and I wish I knew about this technique when teaching Marxism. This is how you get through to the shortest attention span of today's youths. Everyone is so impressed with this brand new teaching method. And I'm imagining classrooms across the country having their teachers do TikTok dances for them. Yeah. People are saying, Alexi, that you ate and left no crumbs.
Yeah.
Any idea what that means?
I think it's a quote from Marx, isn't it? It's about the bourgeoisie, I'd imagine, which is also a rather cruel reference to my weight.
It's not. It's nothing to do with your weight, sir. No. It's a new TikTok lingo. Maybe it is. It means you ate and left no crumbs. It comes from the drag scene, I believe. A lot of this TikTok does. Because a lot of people are saying slay king to you as well. And it just means good show, well done. Yeah. You ate and left no crumbs, like you ate it up. You ate the whole scene up. And people are telling you that you're slaying. This is what TikTok was created for. Fuck me, Alexi doing a TikTok dance in my For You page. I don't know what this world is, but I love it. Shit like that, okay? Incredible comments. But on TikTok, still only 6,000 followers. But here is where the shock twist comes. We're nearly done. We can introduce our guest.
Shock twist.
I posted the videos on Instagram.
Yeah.
I didn't have that muting problem with Instagram. So the long video is unedited and beautiful on Instagram.
Yeah.
The first video, 71,000 views.
Right.
The second video, 528,000 views.
Carmelita.
And the third video, 552,000 views. Fuck. And in the last few days, we've gained 17,000 followers. We now have 22,800 followers on Instagram. This is the most...
Yeah.
This podcast was already the most popular thing I've ever been a part of and the most kind of views I've ever seen on anything, you know, and especially that Christmas video we made.
Yeah.
Like, I've never touched anything that has gotten that much attention. And now we've broken that record for me personally. I know you're used to having 4 to 6 million viewers a week.
When I was
back in the 90s when there were only three channels on telly.
In the 90s.
Yeah.
When you had to watch me, there was nothing.
It's been a long time for you since that. But your Radio 4 show does get millions of... Yeah. But this is fucking new for me. This is over a million views on a stupid... On an old man doing a dumb dance in his garden, and it's incredible. And I'm blown away. This is encouraging me to do more of this. Have you got it in you to do some more of these, Alexei? Yeah. Tell me your reflections. Tell me what you thought about that day and what you think about this new information.
No, well, I think that, it's very gratifying. Obviously, you had me worried there with the TikTok figures because I thought I'd already peaked, really. The internet is a very cruel mistress in that way. So it's nice to see that for whatever fucking reason, it's impossible to... divine why, but obviously on Instagram it's still catching fire, and we'll see where that goes. Really,
I think every 15 minutes we're getting another 100 followers on Instagram currently, something like that.
It's okay, so crazy. I think it's stupid, but it's obviously stupid on one level, and it's ridiculous and kind of absurd old man dancing on his back patio. Actually, I noticed one of the comments on YouTube says, it looks like a nice house for a Marxist. And it's perhaps something we can address in later videos, because that's a fundamental misunderstanding of Marxism, that Marxism is not a kind of philosophy of self-deprecation. All Marxism is an analysis of history and then a suggestion for how to move the game on, as it were. Based on that analysis of class, so that the commentator on YouTube, your analysis is wrong, comrade, and I think you need a long session of self criticism and possibly transfer to a Labour camp. I think that it's interesting to see how we can keep this going. Really, the first one is just a general, essentially just a general kind of some nuggets about what Marxism is. I think in this, if we do some more, then I'll tackle some, drill a bit deeper down into, and maybe we can either do false consciousness, which is where, of course, we get Marx's great quote that religion is the opium of the people. And it's basically an analysis of how people conspire in their own oppression, really. That really Marx, as far as I know, Marx and Engels got there first and it's as true today, or more true today in a sense as it's ever been. So perhaps we can do false consciousness, or we can do alienation, whereas Marx and Engels analyzed I talked a little bit about that, where I was saying that the worker in feudalism works their own land, and in capitalism has to go to essentially where the capitalist is.
Yeah.
And we can talk more about alienation and about, the nature of production, really, that how capitalism is, the worker makes something and then the capitalist, the owner of the factory, then takes often a large part of the profit that arises from the making of that production, and therefore the worker, the person who makes that product, is alienated from, was our agent calling there, is alienated from that from what they make, really. And so and it also points out to, you know, which is never acknowledged, that capitalism, this system, this economic system under which we live, is a system of exploitation. It is, the worker is always exploited.
Indeed. And
there are a lot of conclusions that can be derived from that, really. So maybe we'll do that. So either alienation, surplus value, or false consciousness, I think, in the next video, and more stupid dancing.
Amazing. And speaking of alienation, I fear maybe we're alienating our guest.
Yes, our guest. First of all, because the link had gone into it's Esther Manito, but her link had gone into a
junk
folder. And so I did the basis, I think, of my Eddie Izzard style act in a foreign language, you know, because my French was going to be start off with liberté, égalité, salon d'été. And similarly, I just said, where's Esther? But I said it in Spanish, which is actually, ¿dónde está? Está. Where is ¿dónde está? Está. So that's my entire Eddie Izzard. Anyway, hi Esther, thank you for sitting through our.
No, I enjoyed it.
Thank you.
And also, just to let you know, ate and left no crumbs is not referenced to your weight. It is 100% down to, it's an expression of when somebody executes something flawlessly.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Well,
there you go.
Thank you. And thank the internet. I thought it was like who ate all the pies or something like that.
No. No, that's a very different meaning. I don't think kids say that nowadays.
It's all dependent on how many crumbs are left. That's
I see. Well, it's very gratifying to hear that.
Yeah.
That's one of the things I think that I have contributed to the culture, really, is that chant, you know, at football matches, you fat bastard, you fat bastard, you fat bastard, which I think comes from my TV show, you know, in which the opening would always be, somebody would say about me, who's that fat bastard?
Wow.
Not a positive thing to have.
You're taking credit for you fat bastard.
Yeah.
Huh.
You can't prove I'm wrong.
Is that what you're going to have on your headstone?
Yes, possibly. Yes. That's really good. You know, you fat bastard.
It should be a double wide.
Some weight.
Yeah. Yeah.
It should be a double wide grave.
Yeah. Yeah. Who's that fat bastard? When I was in. When we were in Hollywood, during my failed career in the United States, we went to the Hollywood Cemetery, which is just behind Paramount Studios, and Mel Blanc, who did all the voices of the Looney Tunes characters, is buried there. And his gravestone says that that's all, folks.
That's great. Yeah.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
That's good. I don't know what I'll have on mine.
Spike Milligan, of course, wanted to have.
Yeah.
I told you I was ill.
That's brilliant. Told you I was sick.
Oh, that's great.
He had it in Irish Gaelic, didn't he, on his?
Did he?
Yeah. Told you I was sick.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, I don't know. Well, maybe you could think about your gravestone, and maybe the listeners would like to think about their own gravestones.
I invite the listeners to think about their own death.
Dwell on their own mortality. Let's just
send them in on a postcard.
Dwell on our own mortality. It's bizarre that the majority of people in this country, when they die, are rendered into the hands of the co-op as well. I don't know what that says about our society.
Oh God, it's so Oh God, there is nothing that's out of the grasp of making money, is there?
No. Anyway, Esther, welcome to the show. Tell us a little bit about yourself. Really, I've seen you at many benefits.
Palestine. And for those at home who don't know Esther, if you've had your head buried in the sand, she's an incredible, brilliant stand-up comedian who I've had the pleasure of gigging with a lot, and we both kind of started around the same time, isn't it? And you were like working as a lecturer when you first started.
I was lecturing a little bit and then doing stand-up comedy.
And I had the pleasure of seeing you fucking rocket to full-on fledged professional comedian and fucking live at the Apollo and all that. And it's and you've got a tour coming up. So
I do have a tour coming up.
You're quite outspoken about Palestine, so this was a great fit to have you come on the show here.
So yes, I do have a tour coming up And yeah, it's called Slag Bomb. I will be talking a little bit. Which I'm trying to do more of, because my comedy has never been political per se. I'm not somebody who talks about politics in detachment from my own domestic living. So it's a way of talking about the impact of what's been going on when you're here and you have family in the region, and how that kind of impacts just everyday daily life, because it's quite surreal, isn't it? I mean, you've been in that situation, I know, Talal, with the situation in Syria. It's quite surreal when you're here and then you've just got this kind of family who are living in very, very different situation, and you carry a real guilt as well, don't you? Of like, what kind of world is it where the luck of the ground that you're born on?
Yeah, it depends like how much danger you're in every day and how much death you see around you. You're half Lebanese, of course.
Tell us a bit more about how you came to your family history, and how that's affected you, and how your road to comedy, really, I suppose.
So, my family history. Well, the Phoenicians. So my dad's from Lebanon. My mum's from Gateshead. But my dad was essentially a bit of a nightmare. And just kept getting kind of like kicked out of schools and various education institutions for just being a nightmare.
In Lebanon.
And then he went to Egypt and just pissed fart about there. He was always very political, always very active. And then he ended up coming to the UK when he was 14. And he got enrolled for his A-levels at 14.
With his family?
No, on his own.
Really? Wow.
That's because they were like, right, you're going to England because you've literally caused enough trouble.
Yikes. Which flavour of Lebanese? Is it Sunni, Shia?
He's Sunni.
Sunni, right.
Yeah. Something recently, which I've been getting a lot of trolling about, which is really weird because I'm not religious, but I had people following me, and then all of a sudden I started getting this, I thought you were Christian Lebanese, didn't realise you were a Muslim one. And I was like, okay, like, that's crazy. I think people assumed that I was Christian Lebanese, maybe because, I don't know. But the moment I started speaking about Palestine, they were like, oh, you're a Muslim one. It's like, Muslim Christian, why wouldn't I be speaking out about Palestine?
Anyway, so your dad came at 14. He was just sent here to do his A-levels.
Yeah, imagine it. Well, yeah.
How did that work? I mean, was that a more tolerant time, presumably, in a sense?
Well, I think back then as well, if you just kind of rocked up places and said, here's a letter, it wasn't as, you know, kind of tech Tracy as it is today. And so he ended up doing his A-levels, and then he went on to Newcastle to do his degree. And
right, sorry, can I just, Linda wants to, sorry, can I just briefly pause? Yeah, go on. No, it's not the thing to say. The observer doing a piece about Did you hear that?
Yeah, I've just spoken to the observer before coming on here.
Oh, right, about the Palestine Action thing? Or
no, it's about the, because I signed a letter to what they called Lockwood Martin. We're having a conference.
Lockwood Martin, King's Place.
So yeah, I was one of the people signed.
Yeah.
So the observer just wanted to talk about, you know, has, you know, the the impact of artists signing or boycotting.
Yeah.
And I was just saying to them, actually, I was like, you know, it's such a difficult one because, and I guess this comes down to a kind of capitalist market. It doesn't matter how high you climb up on anything, because there are so few corporations that are all interlinked and intertwined that own any kind of large space or or any kind of, you know, mainstream product, that you will end up. So at the end of the day, you can't expect artists en masse to boycott, because they've got to work. People have to pay bills, and you'll always find that link. But it's so important that artists are putting pressure on, because we are such a huge vocal space. So it's it's been. She said to me, "Oh, have you lost work?" And I think I have, but I was just like, I can't say for sure. But I think
I'm sure you have.
But anyway.
It's difficult, obviously, to ask people to. But I think that it feels like, I don't know, it's to so many false dawns, but it feels a little like the weather seems to be changing towards Israel. All those, I mean, people like Zadie Smith and Salman Rushdie, I don't think they're trying to cover their own arses in a way, that they've seen that the revulsion towards Israel is so great that
they now
want to pretend that they condemned it all along. I mean, Tracy Emin, for God's sake.
I really have to try and not get angry when I hear, every time I hear, the narrative is changing.
Yeah.
The language is changing. The news are saying it, you know, even politicians are starting to speak out. It makes me furious, because is this like, is this what it took? Like, this is the limit then. Now we know how many dead children. And it just makes me so angry. But it's like, from the beginning, we were saying it's not too late to join the right side, and we have to stand by that, I suppose.
Yeah.
Be annoyed, though, if they get all the...
they get the credit,
They get the kudos.
No. It's the people that put the pressure on, but they're the ones who can help make the change, and that's why you just need to say it's not too late, because the moment we stop seeing each other as human beings is the moment we've completely failed. So we have to. We just have to. You have to see the humanity in people. Otherwise, it's going to destroy. It's going to eat you up inside, and it will make you. Angerness is nothing but a cancer, and so you've got to just keep.
But that's you're describing the average Israeli, aren't you? You know, refusing to see the humanity of Palestinian or the average.
Yeah.
Average Robert Jenrick.
Yeah.
The average Jimmy Badenoch. Fucking idiots.
God, that's Jimmy Carr thing.
Jimmy Carr, yes.
Isn't that mental? Because everyone was like, yeah, but he must have been paid, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, the man's a millionaire. He doesn't need it.
Yeah.
And even like from a kudos status, it's like Kemi Badenoch and Nigel Farage. These are people that you'd be like mocking on 8 out of 10 cats. Like, what?
Yeah.
That's so weird.
Yeah.
He's
very weird.
Well, I don't know him, obviously. I met him once. He was very nice to me. But, I don't know. I mean, fucking Maria Eagle as well. I mean, all those fucking people speaking at that thing, you know.
Yeah.
Ugh, terrible. Anyway, we were talking about, so your father, sorry, Linda came in and disturbed me.
That's all right. But I love that you said Linda's coming in. All I could hear was the sound of a cat. I was like, wow, this man's got a really, really intense relationship with his cat. Sorry, I'm going to have to stop. Linda's coming.
Hello, Wilf. Hello, Wilf. You were telling us about your dad.
He ended up going to Newcastle University, and he joined the Communist Society. Right. And
what year was this? When would this be?
Fucking hell, I don't know. I'm so cut with dates. I mean, if he was born 46, was he born 1946? So
I don't know.
I can't work any dates out. I don't know.
I would say he was 20,
probably early 70s, late 60s.
Yeah.
Before he was at Newcastle University before the Civil War in Lebanon. Before things got really shitty. Yeah.
And then that's where he met my mum, doing sit-ins and protests against the Vietnam War. And so then they went back to Lebanon. My sister was born in Beirut. And that's when things started to kick off. She was born under fire. And then they moved to Greece, where they had my middle sister. And then they came here and had me.
Okay. All right. And so what was that experience like? I mean, it's interesting. And I don't know whether, obviously, this is a distorted sample group, but it seems to me a lot of particularly women comedians that I have seen at Palestine benefits seem to have a similar background to you, in that one parent is either Arab or from the subcontinent, Indian, Pakistani, and one isn't really.
I think being mixed heritage gives you a real identity challenge.
Yeah.
And I think it makes you become quite a chameleon. And I think it makes you really morph into lots of different identities. And I think that creates a lovely foundation for comedy.
Yeah, that kind of tension, really, yeah.
Yeah, I think the fact that you're navigating two worlds continuously, because you've got two parents who are from two different worlds, and then you're born into a third different entity, and then you're navigating between the two of them, I think it creates a lot of comedy material, definitely.
I mean, how was that experience for you specifically growing up? I grew up
in Essex, but during the time of the Gulf War. Right. So, and I grew up in, I would say, quite a right-leaning Tory town. There was an army barracks, so it was very, and at the time, obviously, all popular culture was continuously embedding the notion that Arabs are backwards, savage, disgusting, dirty. I talked about this in one of my shows that I took up to Edinburgh, where I was just showing all the things that you were growing up watching, you know, Inspector Gadget, Transformers, and how they just all had embedded images and rhetoric about Arabs that as a child you're just absorbing. So that was not fun. Growing up in that small town.
It's an interesting, interesting, it just occurred to me when you talk about an army town that I remember going, we just had a day out in Windsor, you know, which is fine. You had a nice day. But then occasionally you'd see some men, young men in the street, and you think those people, their behavior and their attitude and their appearance, they seem fucking crazy. And of course they were soldiers.
Yeah.
And so I can't remember who it is. There was a comic. I can't remember who it was now. I think it was from Aldershot of my generation, or maybe slightly later. So, you've got within your midst these fucking insane individuals. I mean, deliberately kind of driven insane in a sense. I don't know whether that affected.
I mean, growing up, because I never went to, so we had like squaddy pubs. And so you just never went to those pubs. Yeah. So I didn't really interact that much with the army guys. Squaddy Street.
Squaddy Pilates Studios.
Yeah, it's all very divided. Pilates Studios. But I will say this. There was I was part of the town band. Hello. And and the young guys who couldn't afford musical instruments, if you join the army town band, you were taught how to play an instrument and you were given the instrument to play. So they would come and play sometimes with the town band, and they were the nicest blokes ever. And I did realise that the army, it did make me realise how much the army for working class people can provide.
Yeah, workers in uniform.
If you're going into, you know, it can provide skills and a job and security, and that's what, you know, it really plays on. But obviously it's also training people to kill, which has it's never natural, it's never normal, it's never healthy, is it?
No, but that's a fair corrective, really, to my middle-class horror there of being in Windsor for the day. That, to point that out, that it is, the armed forces, I mean, particularly in the United States, but even here, the armed forces are a kind of route to, to...
Yeah, I think
that's a selling point, isn't it? Always on the TV ads, it's always a selling point. It's like, you can use it as a way to get an education, build your skills. And even I've seen army adverts where they talk about life after the army. And it's like, come back to the world with new skills, kind of thing.
The veterans are treated so badly. I mean, the volume now of blokes in, you know, khaki camouflage gear sat begging in tube stations and stuff, and you're like, these are young guys who would have gone, this is a way out, this is a way of having a little bit of, you know, kind of status and money and all the rest of it. And then they get sent into these, I mean, can you imagine, like, you know, where they've been sent and the things they would have been groomed and the things they've seen and they're, you know, the way they're kind of pushed. And I know everybody has the right to make their own decisions, but it's so easily said, isn't it? It's so easily to, and I just think, and then they're kind of turfed out and you just think the whole thing is so in bleak, the whole concept, the whole war machine, you know, you just groom these young people and you shove them in to do violent things. That's going to mess up their mental health. And then all these people are just killed and maimed and tortured. And it's just the whole thing. And the only people profiting from it is some fucking bastard who sat with his hands in his pocket. And you're just like, how does anyone think, oh, this will bring democracy? This is the way to bring peace to a region. Yeah. No, you're not. You're just destroying human beings on that.
Yeah. I mean, what you're describing really, I mean, that's Israel, isn't it? An entire country that is a fucking militarized, insane society, I think.
Do you think that, because we're starting to see now, I don't know if you're starting to see it on Instagram, the protests that are starting to happen in Israel?
Yeah, I think there's still very few. The Israeli public, by and large, in a sense, because they're lied to, but still seem to be kind of on board with the genocide, really. I mean, apart from a few brave individuals. I mean, more and more brave individuals, but, you know, it's still a long way to go with the Israeli.
I know, like those young people who are refusing to join the army.
Yeah.
And you just see videos and they're just having the shit kicked out of them.
Yes. It's a fucking, I don't know. Yeah, I just, I mean, but the analogy with like the armed force, I remember years ago, it was when I was working mostly as a writer and going to a poetry reading at the Imperial War Museum. And there was a poet there who was being a former US Ranger and there was British kind of military brass there. And he'd written this poem, I don't know what it's called, Hear Bullets, particularly really amazing poem called Hear Bullets, about saying, you know, I'm here, bullet, come and get me, you know, here. It's about the kind of experience of being under fire, really. But then he suddenly started talking about how in the States there's huge facilities for members of the armed forces, both mostly female but male as well, who've been raped by other members. And he said also in Britain, don't tell me that you have also got epidemic.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Of sexual violence, and the top brass got so uncomfortable at this, really. But I think, expanding that out to
well,
Israel,
also
I think
if you're using sexual assault as a war tactic as well, then it's going to happen within its own units. Not just you're creating a mentality towards violence and rape, which is incredibly skewed.
So we've wandered a long way from your reminiscences of multicultural being brought up falafel sandwiches at school for lunch. And
I didn't have the same experience. I remember Talal when you used to do your stand-up about your mum going, I will make her a sandwich so normal.
Yeah.
And she was drizzling the olive oil over your Philadelphia.
Don't give away my material, please. That's the only material I have. I still do it now. Stop. Okay. Mum would make me a Philadelphia sandwich like I requested, but it would be in pita bread with olive oil lovingly drizzled on it. You didn't have those packed lunches?
No, because, well, my mum did my packed lunches, but I remember because my mum was a full-time teacher and she had three kids, so she used to get us the pre-packed sandwiches from Waitrose, which I used to hate because we only had Waitrose. Hello. Tesco's came along in the 90s and we were very excited about it.
Yeah.
But there was only a Waitrose and we used to have these Waitrose pre-packed sandwiches and I used to hate them. I used to hate them. I used to cry because I hated them. So I ended up having school dinners in the end, which was pretty bleak. But no, I didn't have the Syrian lunchbox.
So that what was your so what did your dad do? I mean, is he still alive, your father?
Yes. I've had somebody troll it because I ran recently the Manchester Marathon for Medical Aid Palestine, and I posted a picture of me and my dad, and my dad wears the kefir. He always has worn the kefir, and somebody wrote underneath going, I'm going to investigate your dad because I want him to be deported. He should be deported. And I was like, well, if you could do it before Sunday, that would be really helpful because he's doing my fucking nothing.
Is he still in work?
No. He's retired. He's in his late 70s. But he worked for a company that created like audio engineering. And so they'd go into buildings like United Nations buildings and stuff. And so, you know, the equipment that translates everything into different languages when someone's speaking. Right. He was the audio engineer that fitted that equipment.
Wow.
So he went to all the embassies. There's not a country on the planet he hasn't been to that yet, apart from Israel, but he hasn't been to that's fitted in United Nations buildings, and embassies and stuff. Sick.
Sounds interesting. Yeah. So, you growing up at school, and I mean, how did your mixed background affect, you know, your friendships and who do you mix with and so on and so forth?
It was not straightforward. There was quite a lot of racist rhetoric. Even my teacher would call me a dirty Arab.
As a joke.
No, he would just be, I remember once, like in RE, he was just like, I was just shut up, like, put your hand down, you dirty Arab.
Fucking hell.
Yeah. So it was just kind of commonplace. It was just,
yeah, I had fat Arab, hairy Arab, sweaty Arab.
Well, because the word Arab was an insult.
It's a four-letter word.
So messed up. It wasn't even, you know, the sweaty, the hairy, the whatever. That wasn't even, that, you know, was kind of the okay bit. It was the main weight of the insult was by calling you an Arab. And so when I started doing comedy, I still was like, wow, because I came from this small town where you would almost try and shield your identity somewhat. Hmm. So when I started doing comedy, those very first few gigs, I kept saying Middle East. And I wasn't even conscious of it until somebody who was at one of the gigs went, why are you saying Middle East? Like, what does that mean? Like, it just makes the audience go, well, where? You know, Turkey, Israel, Syria? Like, what were we talking about? And I was like, Oh, yeah. I've realised I'm saying that. Not so much in London. In London, I'd say Lebanese or Arab. But when I was out of London and I suddenly felt I was in these like parochial areas, which were like the area that I grew up in, I would suddenly go Middle East because I was too terrified to say Arab. So I realised that actually it had really been embedded in me how much Arab was this negative word. So I forced myself. I was like, right, no, I've got to be really conscious of that. So I forced myself to be speaking more and more Arab culture, Arab dad, so that that's the only way you normalize it. Because then people who may have had the same thinking and breeding that I've been embedded with growing up are then walking away going, that's just family, isn't it?
And so what was your route into comedy then? You went to university and all that stuff?
I went to university and all that stuff. I was a teacher, and then I didn't start doing comedy till I was in my 30s, and I was on maternity leave with two babies.
Wow.
Some would say that I turned postnatal breakdown into a career. That's what I was saying.
Well, you know, whatever works, I guess, in a sense. I mean, you were a college lecturer, or you were teaching.
I taught all over, but when Talal met me, I was lecturing at UEL for a little bit, and I was on the foundation sociology degree there. But I taught film and media at sixth form mainly.
Mm. Were you in that? I was a college lecturer. Was it the same union, NATFAHI, the National Association of Teachers in Further and Higher Education?
No, I was in
NATFAHI.
I remember NATFAHI. I was, who was my union? NUT I was with.
NUT, fair enough.
Yeah.
But that is quite, because I mean, I know academia is not what it was, but to be teaching at university, on the university and even sixth form, to be teaching media and stuff, to, you know, you get your, like, holiday, I mean, you get holiday pay and a pension, and then to give all that up for the life
of a
strolling minstrel.
Don't. I sometimes think about sick pay and I'm like, God, isn't it lush? Yeah. It's so lush, because obviously now if you're sick, that's it, you lose your money.
I used to think, it's like my best friend Harry, you know, worked on the buses, and London Transport had, they had like a flying club and a fucking, you know, like a rifle club, and, you know, they had extensive rehab facilities for all their drunken tube drivers and bus drivers.
But they bloody need it.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
It wasn't altruism.
But I just thought sometimes, you know, I mean, it's not, you know, they, I remember his garage, it was more complicated, but I mean, going on strike because there was no toast in the canteen. And I just think, if you're a fucking comedian, I mean, they're like, you know, people complain. This is not a criticism. It's just an observation. The people, you know, get fired and are freaked out about it. You get fired every night, in a sense, don't you, as an entertainer? As an actor, you get fired after a few weeks. You know, the constant insecurity of our lives. We're the ones who suffer the most.
Do you think that's I'm just thinking about the whole idea now that cancel culture is rife. Do you think it is? Do you think it's something that's effective, or do you think it's almost like a bit of a
Damocles sword? The French have a kind of hors de combat, you know, outside of kind of the battle, really. You know, I think I'm kind of hors de combat in a sense. I don't know is my answer. What do you mean by? Let's go back to why you. We'll circle back to that.
Sorry.
But first of all, let's just. So you gave up your pension and your health benefits and a life of respect to become a clown.
Well, I don't know. Teachers are respected. Let's be honest.
That's true.
No.
Especially media teachers.
Especially media teachers. Especially because I was teaching at a school literally just before I. When I quit stand-up, I was teaching at a school, and you would just have loads of students who would just be like, so I can't do your subject because my parents are like, you have to do proper subjects. And you'd just be like, okay. we're not doing your crappy subject. So, it probably didn't have respect. I wouldn't say it had respect, but it was a 9-to-5. I had my weekends off. I had sick pay. I had the holidays and I had a pension. Yes, you are right. You are right. So I went on maternity leave and had kids, but I do sometimes think now, for the money that I earn doing, let's say, a 20 minutes at the store, I would have had to have done 5 hours of shouting.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
So yeah, there is the money that. So I had two small kids. I was on, my daughter was not two yet. My son was 5 months. And I did a comedy course and really just to kind of get out the house once a week and, you know.
Which was the comedy course?
It was the one at Camden Comedy School.
I don't know. Who's the moving? Who's the genius behind that?
Keith Palmer, I think.
Don't know the gentleman, but I'm sure he's fine. Hmm.
I think with a lot of these courses, what it is, it's just the kick to kind of get you on stage, really, isn't it? Because I didn't want to do stand-up. I was like, my friend wanted to do the course. I was like, I'll just come along. So then it's something to do once a week that is not being sat at home with two kids. Right. It's something that's, you know, creative and different and a bit exciting. But I think if you want to get into stand-up, it's quite daunting to just go, I'm just going to go to this local open mic and just stand up on stage. It is quite a daunting experience. Yeah. So I think comedy courses are quite a good way of creating a unity with a group of people that you can then have that support and eases you into it. But yeah, I hadn't planned to do stand up whatsoever, but we did the course. And at the end of the course, we had to do a showcase at Backyard.
I know it.
Which I did, which I drank about 4 gins before doing. And I think the video is somewhere. I cannot find the video, but when I did it, I am talking so slowly because I'm quite drunk and I need to get my words out clearly. That was it. The bug bit me a bit, well, a lot. And then that was it. I started rocking up at different open mics. And then I think it was about a year and a half in, I did my first Arabs Not Funny, and that's where I met Talal. You were hosting.
Right, yeah.
Your partner was fully supportive of this.
My partner, I didn't tell him at first. So when I did sit him down to tell him, he was like, thank God, I genuinely thought you were having an affair. Because I'd been sneaking out once a week going, I'm going to meet my friend for coffee. And then I'd come back. Well, how's your friend? Yeah, fine. When I did my first stand-up in the course, the adrenaline, this is, and I still have horrific stage fright now, but the adrenaline of even standing, because being somebody, I mean, yes, I was a teacher, but it's not the same. You're not having to kind of seek the approval. And, you know, having two children and, you know, I'm still kind of in that weird post having a baby. So everything's like still very saggy and uncomfortable and you feel quite self-conscious. And so standing in front of a group of 30 people and telling jokes, I left there and I just puked all the way home to just keep getting off the tube and puking just because of the adrenaline of, oh my God, I did that. So I'd come in, you know, each week looking a little bit kind of like, ah! And clearly looking very suspicious and edgy. And my husband was like, okay. And it took me about 6 weeks before I eventually was like, got something to, and imagine of all confession. The things he was expecting. He's sitting there going, oh my God. I mean, firstly, what woman after giving birth 5 months ago is out shagging about? I don't know, but she would have to have, she would have to have absolute brilliant bounce back ability and energy levels. But but all the things he was expecting me to say, imagine your partner sits down and goes, I've started doing stand-up comedy. Like, sorry, what? It must have just been like, I've got something to tell you. I've become a unicyclist.
I'm joining the circus.
It must have changed your domestic routine, presumably.
Yeah, I mean, it did get to a point where it was like, because when you do the open mics, obviously, you're not earning and you have to stay there till the end of the night. And a lot of them are like, you've got to bring a friend. And so my husband was like, you know, we've got two small babies, fine. You know, do this a couple of times a week. You know, you want a hobby or whatever, but it's getting like, you know, 3-4 times a week and you're getting in at like midnight and then you're up in the night breastfeeding and then you've got to go to work the next day. Like, this is ridiculous. And he's right. It was. And I was like, no, 100%. You're completely right. But I'm not going to stop.
Right.
And as soon as I started earning and as soon as it became clear that this was going to be my profession, we then just fell into a routine and now we're all just kind of used to it and on board with it. But it did take a bit of adjustment. My God, it did. Wow. Yeah. And all the family were just a bit like, what? What are you doing?
Yeah.
Like, you're mad. Yeah. Like, the only my dad really was my main supporter. Right. If my husband was getting a bit stressed out, my dad would be like, right, I'll take the kids. You go now. Just That's go. Really go fantastic. Do it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Aren't Arab dads great, man? My dad always was like, go express yourself. Yeah. I'm so proud of you. And I'm like, I'm talking to 5 drunk people in the pub. He goes, oh, that's fine. Go do it. You know,
it's so weird because I get so much trolling about how dare you, like, how could you support Gaza? If you went there, you'd be murdered.
You're
a half British person. They would slaughter you. Would do this to you. They would do that to you. And it's like, who do you think I live with? Like, what do you think I've not been? Do you think I've not been there? Like, this perception of, like, the fact that it's just marauding guys who are all just out, like, murdering women and kind of, like, refusing to allow any kind of arts into the community. It's so deranged.
Yeah.
It's so deranged.
They convince themselves of these things to justify
what's happening out there. Of course there are issues in terms of, like, you know, misogyny and homophobia, of course, and there is here.
Yeah,
and also it's like, okay, well, during the 1950s, it wasn't exactly great for women and gays then, but I don't think it's okay to then go and blanket bomb Milton Keynes.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I think Milton Keynes was around in the 50s, wasn't it?
No.
I am. So when you're your comedy, and I don't want to, you know, be derivative, but it's, you know, a lot of your comedy was about your motherhood,
children, family, husband, hairy Arabness as well, a lot of that stuff. And you are, you know, how are you finding incorporating today's conflict into, and like the today's times into your comedy? How is that changing your comedy?
So, because talking about things, and also it's really, well, it is quite hard to make it funny, but I think sometimes the surrealness of a situation. So I describe it. So in my show, I'm talking about things like the fact that kids, you know, my kids are very much like preteen now. And so they're in this kind of self-absorbed little bubble world, which is really normal for that age group. And I suddenly remember when I was that age and my dad would be dealing with, you know, situations back home, but it just didn't register. It didn't penetrate because your parents are just these heroes, aren't they? It's like, well, yeah, but they're not affected by things. They're not real people. They're right. Just put on this planet to protect us, which they will, and they don't have feelings. But then you grow up, and now this situation is happening. And now I've got these kids who are of a similar age, and I'm now like, can you just give me a second while I process this? And they're just like, oh, my God, where's my chicken nuggets? And you're just like, why don't you get it? So it's that kind of scenario where you're just like, why can't you see what's going on? But they can't, and they're kids, and they shouldn't have to. Talking about I've done a couple of marathons now, and I wanted to, my first marathon that I signed up for was before everything had kicked off. And I've done a lot of fundraising for Medical Aid Palestine, but because it was my first marathon, I really wanted to run for a charity that my children chose. I thought that'd be a really lovely way of bonding. And then my daughter chose sloths. A year later, it had all kicked off, and I'm now having to deal with the family going, you're fucking running the marathon for slots whilst the Middle East burns. And so you're then like in this kind of, and then they're like, okay, so now I have to run another marathon because I've got to now raise money. So I'm now having to run 1,000 marathons because I've got to do the right thing. So it's these kind of like ludicrous situations.
You run the marathon for sloth, you run it really, really slowly.
Yeah, really slowly. I know.
Yeah, great.
I was
good
like,
one.
Just yeah.
In the trees, yeah. Somebody else.
And they are such a sweet animal and so adorable, but just maybe not the most pressing thing at that time. And also just like kind of, you know, everyday scenarios where people just want to talk to you about it really casually and they don't realize, like, you know, Talal, when we did that fundraising gig, and it was so lovely because we could all just be really open about how we're feeling. But in other scenarios, you're just rocking up to work or school pickup and all the rest of it, and you're just doing these mundane everyday things, and then somebody might just casually be like, oh, I saw the news, is the family all right? And you're just like, how do you react to that?
Yeah.
Oh yeah. What they're like.
They're like getting themselves bombed by the fucking Israelis,
The my stand-up show does talk a lot about family life, but also now adding this extra layer of like, well, what do you do when you're navigating these two worlds? Also, what do you do when you're trying to get your kids ready for school and they're having a meltdown? And then I've got a dad who's there in his kefir going, and today is the day when they decide. And you're just like, I can't, I don't know how to navigate this. I've literally got one having a meltdown because they can't find their freaking Paw Patrol pencil case, and the other one is screaming in my ear about Keir Starmer's policies. And it's just a colliding of two worlds, because one doesn't neither one recognizes how big the other one's world is to them.
Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah,
and very spectrumy as well. So it's all very kind of like, it's a very cathartic hour.
Because it's, I mean, you know, in a sense, as an artist, times of, you know, terrible suffering for the world are also the time when, as a response to that, you are at your most fertile, aren't you? You know, the greatest modernist, the greatest painting of the 20th century is a response to the carpet bombing of civilians, which is Picasso's Guernica, you know. So I think you have mixed feelings, don't you, about that? I'm talking about myself, I suppose, that it's a kind of gift, this catastrophe, but it's also, and we profit from it, but it's also, we have to acknowledge, you know, it's,
I do,
you
I
feel
do,
weird about that, you know.
I do find as well, and I'm sure Talal will be able to recognize this, I think countries where there is so much chaos, it creates an amazing sense of humor.
Right.
And I think Arabs have a really, really, really good sense of humor.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I don't often see members of my family cry. I'll see them annoyed. I'll see them shout. I'll see them scream. But also they're able to really laugh at the absolute hardest of times. Right. And it, there are, you know, there was a time when me and my cousin were on the phone. It was, I think it was around November when Lebanon was being hit quite badly. And we rang each other and she just went, "Hi, how are you?" And I just went, "Yeah, how are you?" And then we both just started laughing, but we laughed probably for about 10 minutes. I couldn't breathe.
Wow.
And she was just like, you know, what else? Yeah. What else can you do? And it's just like, it's a way, some, I do think Arabs have got a particular, I think Egyptians actually have probably got some of the best sense of humor.
Really,
I think Egyptians are really funny. They're really funny. But I remember when I was in Lebanon, just like the amount of piss taking, it's a real way of showing affection.
Right.
Like my dad would, I see like my mate's dads would be like on their wedding day, they'd be like, "I've watched my little princess. She's so beautiful. And she's all the rest of it." And my dad's way of showing affection is just to whack me around the head and go, you know, what? And you're just like, "Oh, it's a kiss. What's that Billie Holiday song?"
I think also the poorer the Arab is, the funnier they are.
Yeah.
Or the poorer, lower class they come from, because, you know, you go into the Gulf as you travel eastwards and they get richer and richer. They are just sour, serious.
Oh, that's so true. Mind you, I guess that's true of working class here as well. The kind of like club comedy really emanated from working class people. That's where it came from.
But
the volume of lower classes in the Arab world, like, everyone is on their fucking same level.
Yeah.
They are hilarious. And there's so much toilet humor. So much body parts.
Yes, Wasim was like my Palestinian friends, so I could never kind of get on board with that. You were asking me about cancel culture. I didn't quite understand the question earlier. I don't know what I was really asking.
I only caught up to date today. Somebody said to me about the Andrew Lawrence joke about Liverpool. And I was like, well, what's going on here? Are we now saying things to get cancelled to become more popular? Or is it that, like, what's going on here with comedy now? Because I don't understand. It feels like we're in the weird parallel of saying things that meet an echo chamber, but maybe don't necessarily need to. Because who was I watching? I think it was like Dave Chappelle. And I remember his older specials would be like joke, 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 joke. But now it feels like it's more of a monologue. Yeah. And then it's like, so are we now saying things to annoy or to endorse? And if anything, I don't know. I don't know what my question is.
No,
I'm just finding it all a bit strange.
Yeah, no, well, I don't think there is any particularly simple answer, really. I mean, something like Dave Chappelle, I think you're... Well, I mean, I was saying, and I don't. We've talked about him before. We've talked about Jerry Sadowitz before, and I don't know whether he can function in today's climate. But there was a thing where Jerry Sadowitz used to, and if you ever saw him, used to do the most repulsive kind of humor. I mean, the famous one is, you know, Nelson Mandela, "What a cunt! You'll end a bloke £10, and you never see him again." That worked in the 1950s, whatever. But but because Jerry was coming from such a place, you could see that this was a profoundly damaged person. And so you could see that the hate was an act. It was not really what he believed, but it was a persona.
Yeah.
But there was a commentary on how damaged he was and the catharsis of saying unsayable things to a degree, I think. Mm. I mean, with somebody like Andrew Lawrence, it's just a fucking nasty person making a nasty fucking joke, really, isn't it? There's no subtlety there. There's no, I tend to be a free speech libertarian, really. I think that I don't agree with that. I remember Chomsky signed a letter which was mostly right-wing people then, people like Rushdie and writers. But just, you know, just demanding free speech, really. And he was criticised by a lot of the left. But I think by and large, people should be allowed to say, you know, anything.
Oh, that's as like long the Rowan Atkinson and John Cleese opinion.
I tend
as well,
to go along with that. Although, so I think that sometimes we can, on the left, be overly censorious. This might get me into terrible trouble. But I mean, I am a libertarian to a degree on that. But I mean, Andrew Lawrence is just a fucking stupid arsehole. And if he thought that he was going to get away with that, I mean.
I don't think he did think that, though, did he?
You think he wanted the controversy?
Well, I don't know. I don't know him. I don't know anything about it. But I just think, are we now in a place where it's like, the more we've pushed and censored, it's created more people who now want to outrage.
So I think that's certainly true. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely like an alt-right thing is like, yeah, get angry. You know, the whole legalized comedy kind of thing is like, yeah, you snowflake sensitive cucks, get angry. Come on. And I'm going to say, and that's like, and they're like almost doing it as a political point. Whereas coming back to fucking Jimmy Carr, that was his whole shtick 10, 15 years ago, was saying the unsayable and just double downing that it's like, they're jokes, don't get offended. They're just jokes.
Yeah.
And I don't think he was being political by doing that stuff. But nowadays, I think a lot of comics do want to ruffle feathers of the soft, snowflakey, lefty, wokey, lib.
Which doesn't really include the massive Liverpool fans necessarily. But, I don't really quite know what I think, and I've always kind of tried to stay out of that debate, really. So,
I don't really know. I think it's just because it literally just before I picked up the phone, someone had just sent me a link, and I was like, oh, okay, all right,
yeah. I mean, it's just shit on every level, man.
Well, and Alexi, you were briefly cancelled in Liverpool, we mentioned it a few episodes ago,
yes. We talked about the humiliation of.
Why were you cancelled in Liverpool?
I made some fatuous remarks about Liverpool ahead of the capital of culture.
I was actually saying
they had a special. The Liverpool Echo, the local paper, on the Saturday published a special supplement all about. Luckily, it noticed about my remarks really.
But then there is also redemption, because you went up there and didn't apologize.
I was wrong. It was a learning experience for me. It was genuinely humbling, and I learned a lot.
Sometimes we can tell the difference. I think that's the thing. Sometimes, isn't it? It's like you can tell the difference. It's almost like when you hear somebody say something racist, or when you hear your nan say something. Which isn't considered PC now, but you know it comes from no malice. It's like, well, that's just a generational thing where they don't know that language isn't acceptable, you know, or you wouldn't refer to somebody as that, even though you're doing it in a nice, polite way. But there's a difference between that and somebody who's like, oh, you fucking X, Y, and Z. So,
well, I was actually being a prick, and but I think the people of Liverpool realized that my contrition was real, which it was. You know, I wasn't putting it on. I wasn't being contrite to save my skin, but just because I did feel terrible, really, because I had been a prick, you know. So it was really useful experience.
But you've been back to Liverpool since.
Jesus said, you know, something about, you know, the sinner, you know, I can't remember this precise quote, but, you know.
It's got such a gorgeous theatre for comment. What's that theatre that we did, Talal? Is it the Theatre Royal? Is that what it's called?
Possibly. That was a fun day. That's the only time I've been to Liverpool.
I do like Liverpool.
I did like. I mean, my last stand-up gigs were a five-night sold-out run in Liverpool before COVID. And
so where were you, Alex, when you did your...
At Five Nights?
Yeah.
A place called the Epstein Theatre, which closed but is now reopened. Beautiful room. It's about, I think it holds about 500.
Nice. Yeah, they had some nice space. I think it was like the Arab the Liverpudlian Arab Festival we were
I think
up there
I'm a,
for.
I was a sponsor of that, but
oh, really?
They haven't been in touch for about 15 years.
Yeah, I was I was offered to be part of a Debka dancing class, and I was like, yep, right. Nope. I haven't got the spring in my step for that.
Yeah, we were in the Royal Court in Liverpool.
Royal Court, yeah. So, Esther, tell us where your tour's going and what, you know, where people come
by. I've got 17 different locations up and down the country. So, doing from Glasgow all the way down to don't know where anywhere is. Like, I literally have no concept of geography. I just get trains to places and I'm like, where am I, Kent? And they're like, no, you're in Wales. terrible geography. Probably the result of being brought up by two people who neither wanted to believe that they were in the situation they're in.
So, I'm going to help you out here. Here we go. Slag Bomb. Starting in September. I'm going to run. You're going to Norwich, London, Farnham, Birmingham, Manchester, Sheffield, Southend. And then in October, Exeter, Chester, Edinburgh, Swindon, Bristol. November, you're going to Oxford, Leeds, Glasgow, Faversham, Winchester, Leicester, Newcastle. And then in December, haven't? The
yeah,
Spring
haven't.
Arts
Festival. Yeah,
January, Brighton. And then in February,
right.
On my birthday, you're going to be in Guildford. And then Crawley. That's the Slag Bomb Tour. Really nice artwork, actually. Great poster.
Thanks.
That's fucking sick. Well, drinking a WKD.
Thank you. Well, thank you for coming on the podcast. It was fascinating to talk to you. I think we could have... We'd better let you go, really. But there's lots more to unpack. Yeah.
Thanks so much for having me. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Yeah, no, it's been lovely. We really enjoyed it. It's...
I think we could safely say we ate and left no crumbs.
Which is not a cruel remark about our weight. Or a quote from Marx.
It's a whole new thing, a whole new world you're part of now, Lex. Yeah. Slay, King. Slay.
We pongoed and we pogoed and left no dents.
Esther, I'm going to put a link to your tour dates in the description of this podcast. All right.
Thank you. Cheers. Thank you, Esther.
Thanks for having me, guys.
I'm waiting for Alexi's sign off. He's not said it yet.
Oh, bye bye.
There we go.
You've been listening to the Alexi Sell podcast. This show is produced and edited by Talal Karkouti. Music by Tarbush Records. Thanks to Audio Boom for hosting us. Please keep your emails coming in at alexiselpodcast@gmail.com. Goodbye.